Sometimes it all comes down to a coin flip, a die roll. The fastest deck wins the roll, and now everyone is stuck on their back foot when that early aggressive player gets a fast start. Or you wind up sitting to the right of the person who won the die roll, and now you're playing fourth, and you're a step behind everyone else. And worst of all, you're stuck policing the person who went first. Sometimes the deck that normally wants to play a fast, focused game needs to be the fun police, and sometimes the control deck needs to jam the win attempt into an early opening. How are you supposed to balance all of this into a four-player game? Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John, and today we have another lesson from CEDH. CEDH is a metagame within the Commander format that sits at one extreme with highly consistent, highly efficient decks. Not all cards are equally powerful in all formats, or even in all metagames, but there are lessons to be learned from how people are brewing with the most powerful cards available. And the CEDH community came together this past summer for Major League Commander, which showed off some of the best players in the format playing the decks drafted off of the CEDH decklist database. In that format, we saw a huge diversity of decks, as well as guaranteeing all of the players getting their chance for home field advantage and to sit in the first player's seat. So what happened? What we saw during Major League Commander was that the player in the first seat has about a 31% chance to win, which is very close to the 30.06% measured during the Command Zone's analysis of hundreds of different Commander games a few years ago. Each other seat, by the way, has about a 23% chance to win. If all other things are equal, shouldn't each player in a pod have about a 25% chance to win? That's not what the data says. Analyzing the stages of the game and the concept of game actions, which we've done episodes on before, it's not too hard to see why. The first player has the most chances to take game actions before other players can even interact meaningfully. Everyone else is still getting ready, and player 1 might already be all set up. Player 1 can multispell, casting a threat and protecting it from interaction while forcing other players to choose between getting ready or being all set up. Player 1 can take game actions before anyone else can take their own game actions, and sometimes before anyone can even attempt to modify the game actions they are taking. If player 1 plays a land and plays a threat, well, if no one else has played a land yet, they're not going to have any mana available to interact with. Doesn't this tell us that we should just attack player 1 when you have multiple openings? That's all it takes, right? End episode, cue theme song, social medias, like, subscribe, thumbs up, comment, share. Are you kidding? Did you even look at the length of this episode? We're just getting started. You might not be able to control who goes first, but you can improve your chances to win a game by knowing your role at the table. There is a classic article, Who's the Beatdown?, which has been cited to death time and time again in gameplay of turn-based TCGs and CCGs. In the early days of Magic, Mike Flores wrote this article for The Dojo, a now-defunct website dedicated to early Magic theory. One of the keys identified early in the history of the game was to identify what sort of role a player would need to take at the table. In describing a matchup where his very controlling deck was going up against a control deck which was half a step less controlling, Flores wrote, "I was going to win the long game every single time. His job, therefore, was to kill me before I killed him." The article describes the matchup between two aggressive beatdown decks as well, where both players assume that they are the beatdown, and the faster deck inevitably wins that race, because the player with the less aggressive deck failed to recognize who was the beatdown. In his article, Flores identified a checklist of three questions to help him identify who would be assuming which role in the game. Who has more damage? Usually, he has to be the beatdown deck. Who has more removal? Usually, he has to be the control deck. And who has more permission and card drawing? Almost always, he has to be the control deck. Let's look at these questions, and let's modify them for Commander. Which deck is going to put you on the clock earliest? Who can threaten that early Adnaz in a CDH game? Who can suit up a Voltron Commander or spew out a horde of tokens? Which deck has more interaction and answers? Who has dedicated slots to answering earlier threats? Who can afford to one-for-one other opponents to stymie a focused deck sitting across the table? Who is playing the stacks pieces which are preempting opposing strategies? Finally, which decks can reliably play resource engines? Who can draw backup and get back to parity or even get ahead of their opponents after spending answers? Who can draw into an answer for a given stacks piece? If you can answer these basic questions, you'll know who's the beatdown. But Dex and Commander aren't really always like Dex in 60 and 4 or 1 versus 1 formats. I do think there is a similar breakdown which we've described before, and I'm going to argue that Dex and Commander break down roughly into a spectrum of whether they are the focus deck or the value deck. This is our version of beatdown versus control. A focus deck prioritizes threats over answers, optimizing for the short game. A focus deck seeks to close out the game before a value deck can take over. Focus decks will seek to play out their threats and execute on a game plan over disrupting opponents' plans, taking the proactive approach preferentially over being reactive. Some focus decks are more focused than others. Some simply lean focused, and while preferring to execute on a plan for the short game, they can also generate enough resources more like a value deck if the game state requires it. Meanwhile, a value deck prioritizes resource advantage over speed, optimizing for the long game. A value deck seeks to disrupt more focused opponents while creating and exploiting a resource imbalance to win. Value decks will be willing to spend resources to disrupt threats from opponents in a more reactive style, but they aren't primarily reactive. Reactive gameplay is simply a means to push the game towards the long game, where the resource advantage takes over. Some value decks are more value-driven than others, some simply lean value, and while they may be most adept at generating a resource advantage, they can also execute a game plan more quickly than an all-in value deck can react. Your goal should be to identify if the seat you are in is going to favor you taking a focused approach or a value approach. Even if your deck is meant to be the focus deck, if all three of your opponents have lower critical turns than you and quicker clocks on their win conditions, like it or not, at that table, you are the value deck and you need to play like it. Your goal will be to prevent the faster decks from being able to execute on their threats, and you'll need to out-resource them, preventing them from ending the game with their own threats before you can land your more powerful, more late-game threats to overwhelm them. And likewise, if you're meant to be on the value game plan, you might find that sometimes you have multiple opponents with an even better long game than you. You might even have the nut draw, and you can threaten a win much earlier than your deck usually can. In that case, in that seat, you are the focus deck, and you should try to have a plan to end the game before your opponents can out-resource you. Next, you need to know your game plan, and in this case, I mean, what is your path to victory? What does the all-setup stage look like for you? Have you landed your value engines that will generate you value turn after turn? Are you leaning on stacks pieces to slow down your opponents? Or do you have simply enough mana to cast an aggressive threat? Likewise, what does your deck look like when it's going for it? Are you going to be swinging all out with creatures to deal combat damage for the win? Are you planning for a combo that will eliminate all of your opponents at once? Remember, this is a multiplayer game. If you have opponents who are threatening the same axis you are with a similar game plan, you are sort of natural allies. Let's take an extreme example of this. What if two different Infect decks sit down together at the same table? Well, in that case, it really does behoove them if they work together. This could also happen in a slightly more common example if two different Mill decks sit down at the same table. In this case, these players are going for alternate win conditions, but they're attacking the same axis, and each of them is working on the same clock. Let's get into details. Every time Infect player A successfully deals a poison counter to an opponent, that is one less poison counter that Infect player B needs to inflict, and vice versa. Similarly, every time Mill player A successfully resolves a mind grind, player B is that much closer to milling their opponents out as well. In CEDH, we sometimes see this when there are multiple decks on stacks plans, as they, well, stack well with one another. If two decks at the table both want to resolve a rule of law effect, and both are built to operate under it, you're going to have twice as many decks as there are in a usual game trying to resolve and protect a rule of law effect, making it twice as hard for players fighting to avoid rule of laws from sticking to the table to achieve their own game plans. It's very common at more casual tables for combat damage to be the de facto path to victory. But if you are on a particularly aggressive, focused game plan with aggressive creatures, you and another player on a similar focused aggro game plan are best served attacking the more value-heavy decks which threaten to overwhelm both you and your other opponent in the late game. The next question to ask is, who are you sitting next to? Seating matters. Who you are sitting next to is incredibly important. It comes down to the way in which priority is passed in a game of Magic. In Commander, priority passes from active player to non-active player in turn order. So if you are sitting to the left of a player, you become the first player to gain priority when they attempt to cast a spell or take a game action on their turn. Likewise, if you are sitting to the right of a player, you become the last person to gain priority in response to the game actions they take, the final check against their actions. So why does this matter? Let's assume a game where everyone is packing lots of interaction and answers, such as a game of CEDH. It's relatively early, so each player has a fair number of cards in hand, and nobody is empty-handed quite yet. Let's say player 1 then attempts to cast a big threat. After announcing this, player 1 passes priority to player 2. Player 2 knows they have two other opponents who have a similar spread of resources to them, and who likely have answers to that threat. If the threat is serious enough that it must be answered, player 2 has a greater degree of freedom to pass priority with relative confidence that one of either player 3 or player 4 must be able and willing to answer that threat. So, player 2 can pass priority. Player 4, meanwhile, is the last person to get priority. And if they do not answer the threat by the time priority passes to them, the threat will resolve and player 1 could have significantly advanced their game plan or even won the game. Thus, the pressure is on player 4 to spend resources to answer that threat posed by player 1. It is a much higher amount of pressure than is felt by either players 2 or player 3, who can pass the buck on to player 4. Let's get a more concrete example. We're already talking a little bit about CEDH, so in CEDH, an early ad nauseum is often the herald of a quick win. Combining a massive influx of new cards with fast mana, lots of tutors, and compact win conditions means that someone resolving an ad nauseum usually has the tools they need to win. Plus, don't forget they are often drawing into lots of counterspells in order to protect that win. If player 1 is on the early ad nause plan, player 2 is in the most comfortable spot. They can pass priority on the ad nause to players 3 and 4, knowing that one of them will be forced to counter the ad nauseum, spending cards from one of their own hands, while player 2 can hold all the interaction of their own for later when they're trying to win. This extends beyond just the fight on the stack, though. Player 2 is also the one who can most safely get greedy and tap out to develop resources before the critical turn, so they can be the farthest ahead, forcing opponents later in the turn cycle to be the ones who have to hold up and respect that threat. If this sounds interesting to you, we did an entire episode on greed and respect before. Meanwhile, if both player 2 and player 3 get greedy developing their resources and leaving mana up to interact with player 1 going for it on an early turn, player 4 is left in the unenviable position of either needing to get greedy to keep up with players 2 and 3, while also disrespecting player 1's potential threat, or respecting that threat from player 1 and falling far behind players 2 and 3. Where it really gets complicated, though, is the multiplayer nature of Commander. What if there are two focus decks at the table? What if there are three value decks? A pod where players 1 and 4 are on the focused game plan can force some interesting play patterns, where player 4 will often force the last check which they normally would pose to player 1 back onto player 3, who assumes that unpleasant role we described a moment ago of needing to choose between advancing their own game plan or policing player 1. Because do you really expect the other focused deck to be able to manage another focused player at the table? They usually don't have the resources to do so. Player 1, meanwhile, being on that focused deck, is in the relatively enviable position when it comes to player 4's threats, being able to pass the buck to the more value-oriented players 2 and 3. Which means player 3 is caught between a rock and a hard place, representing the final check for both players 1 and player 4. In this scenario, it is usually necessary for both value players to recognize their position and to work together to police early threats from both of the focus players, allowing them to draw the game out to the long game, where their engines are more likely to take over and nullify the threats that players 1 and 4 present. A slightly less extreme version of this happens when the focus decks are staggered, such as when players 1 and 3 are on a focused game plan, and players 2 and 4 are on value game plans. In that case, it falls more naturally for each of the value players to be the final check against the focus player to their left, forcing a more natural expenditure of resources by each of the value players as they try to stop the focused players. Now imagine for a moment what would happen if somebody has misidentified what their role at the table is. If one of those value decks think that they are actually the focus deck, not recognizing the threat that player 1 might represent, where they are the one who are going to be going for it first, they may be passing the buck on critical spells that could potentially lead to detrimental effects to the rest of the table, such as player 1 simply walking to victory when they are able to force through that early ad nauseum. Just something to consider. One of the major advantages of VEDH over in-person play is that it makes it really easy to shuffle seating without needing to move playmats and decks and backpacks all around the table. Use this liberally to keep games fresh. Even something as simple as shifting seats can have a dramatically different play experience for everyone at the table. And that brings us to the end of our discussion on the importance of turn order, seating position, and your role at the table. There's a lot more to cover on this one, and we might have to revisit it again at a later date. Until then, let us know what else needs to be covered. You can leave us a comment on YouTube, where we are Gemstone Mine Podcast, add us on Twitter, where we are at GemstoneMineMTG, or send us an email, where we are GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, I'm John, and this is Gemstone Mine.